So at this time, Mr. Robertson.
We're going to do a little bit of a reshuffle here with the agenda. We're going to move to item 12 now, skipping over item 11 for the time being. So item 12 is the Environmental Justice and Human Right to Water Implementation Update. It's an information item that provides an update on EJ activities in the region and what we've accomplished over the last year, including our efforts to implement the Human Right to Water law consistent with the governor's direction. I would note that the board a year ago at this meeting, it was in January last year, adopted the Central Coast Human Right to Water Resolution and initiated the first work plan associated with that. Section Manager Angela Schroeder will present an overview of the actions staff has prioritized and implemented as part of our 2017 Human Right to Water work plan, and also discuss what the future looks like for us going forward in that context.
Thank you. Once again, good morning, Chair Wolf, members of the board. Angela Schroeder, Supervising Engineering Geologist and EJ Coordinator for the Central Coast Region. Item 12 is an informational item to update the board on our most recent environmental justice activities in the region, including the implementation of the Human Right to Water Law. Before we begin, just some reminders about definitions.
And if I may, I should have indicated that since we started this item, I'm going to close any speaker cards. So if any of you have a speaker card on this item, this is the time to do it. Thank you. Sorry, Angela.
Thank you. So environmental justice is defined by the California statute as the fair treatment of people of all ethnicities, cultures, and incomes with respect to the development, adoption, implementation, and enforcement of all environmental laws, regulations, and policies. In 2012, California advanced its commitment to environmental justice and became the first state in the nation to legislatively recognize the human right to water. Governor Brown signed into law the Water Code Section 106.3, which declares every human being has the right to safe, clean, affordable, and accessible water adequate for human consumption, cooking, and sanitary purposes. The Human Right to Water Law further requires all relevant state agencies, including the Regional Board, to consider the human right to water when revising, adopting, or establishing policies, regulations, and grant criteria relevant to domestic water uses. So at the Central Coast Water Board, environmental justice and the human right to water law shapes our priorities, frames our projects, and informs our actions. And over the last year, staff has continued to address environmental justice issues and implement the human right to water by coordinating with State Board, our external environmental justice organization partners, to outreach to disadvantaged communities, or DACs, and then also work with the regulated community within multiple water board programs to improve water quality, reduce polluting, and ensure safe drinking water. So as this is no new information, as has been a key focus of the Central Coast Water Board for the last several years, nitrate impacts to groundwater continues to be the highest priority water quality issue related to environmental justice and implementation of the Human Right to Water Law in the Central Coast region. So I know we all know that, but just to reaffirm that is one of our key priorities. The core of the nitrate issue relates to both the degree of nitrate loading to groundwater from leaching of nitrogen fertilizers and other sources, and the resulting severity of impacts, drinking water, and risk to public health that affects municipalities, small communities, and individuals across the region. And as Mr. Jordan mentioned this morning, these are important issues that we must resolve. So this is the most recent map from GeoTracker. This looks at all sources of nitrate groundwater data from the Central Coast region. The results indicate that of nearly 10,000 groundwater wells region-wide, more than 19% exceed the maximum contaminant level for nitrate. For some counties, like Monterey County, more than 25% of groundwater wells exceed the maximum contaminant level. So in response to this issue, our Central Coast Water Board priorities for environmental justice and human right to water continue to focus on efforts to ensure safe drinking water, including providing replacement drinking water in areas of known contamination, testing domestic wells where there's a lack of data and where users may be uninformed about drinking water quality, supporting innovative drinking water treatment technologies to help address the needs of rural areas where consolidation may not be an option, conducting outreach and providing technical support to disadvantaged communities so they are better equipped to access resources and grant funds, and finally continuing to advance requirements to reduce pollutant loading to drinking water sources. While these efforts are a high priority, they are a challenge for the Central Coast Water Board because we do not receive any staff resources specifically for environmental justice. Thus, our environmental justice-related activities are generally addressed using existing Water Board program staff and funding and by leveraging additional capacity through our collaboration with our external partners. So this slide summarizes the progress we've made in 2017. And as Mr. Robertson mentioned, one of the board's first actions in 2017 was to adopt a regional human right to water resolution, which included an actionable work plan, which is included as attachment one to your staff report. I'm pleased to report that while the Central Coast Water Board has no dedicated funding to conduct EJ activities or implement the human right to water law, staff has made substantial progress on nearly every project in the 2017 work plan due to our effective internal coordination and our ability to leverage additional capacity through our external partners. For example, the safe drinking water grants that you might remember being updated on, we use settlement funds to provide grants to EJCW as well as CURES to deliver more than 30,000 gallons of interim safe drinking water to economically disadvantaged communities in northern Monterey County. This is the Las Lomas area. And our grants coordinator, Katie McNeil, was also able to extend the provision of that safe drinking water into the future by helping the community to access cleanup and abatement account funds. We also conducted a San Luis Obispo County domestic well sampling project. We collaborated with the AmeriCorps Civic Spark Program and also with San Luis Obispo County Environmental Health to successfully launch this free private domestic drinking water well project for the residents of SLO County, which included the piloting of the Nitrate app as well as uploading all groundwater results to GeoTracker. We also received volunteer assistance from a graduate student with a master's in public health to develop an annotated bibliography to comprehensively review and analyze the most recent research on the health outcomes related to nitrate exposure from drinking water that has become available as a result of new monitoring efforts and data sources. We also participated in the UCLA pilot project. Our grants and permitting staff collaborated with State Board and UCLA using cleanup and abatement account funds to implement wellhead treatment using reverse osmosis and operated with innovative remote telemetry, and some oftentimes referred to as virtual consolidation or the virtual water district, to three disadvantaged communities in the Salinas Valley. And as you heard during item 10, we are working with the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement and the Salinas Basin Stewardship Group to provide interim replacement water, and that effort continues.
Can you, but maybe we can ask a few questions. I'd like to hear more about where we are with the UCLA project.
Sure. So the UCLA project, we participated in that effort to help them to both use the grant funds allocated to UCLA to design the project using the reverse osmosis as in addition to the remote telemetry. So our primary role in that project was to look at the permitting process related to the discharge, and we did that successfully. We looked at adding specific monitoring requirements to confirm what was being described by UCLA as a minimal discharge, and Harvey Packard can probably comment on that. But at this point, that project is with the Division of Drinking Water, and they are working to permit the system. So we've addressed the discharge issues at this point.
So what's the timetable?
So that project is supposed to be permitted this calendar year. In fact, I think it's right about now. It was supposed to be the beginning of 2018. The actual launching of the construction part of the project is actually fairly straightforward. It's all
It's modular,
contained in a 40-foot container. It's portable.
So is there, you know, I'm looking at the time, you know, from the time we talked about this project to now, and the months and the years goes by. So what's our dialogue with our counterpart drinking water division to, you know, I'll call it, lack of a better word, put this on fast track so we move on, and it becomes, that picture becomes the picture of a system installed in our Central Coast region?
We can certainly continue our coordination and evaluate the priorities with them, but right now it's in their court.
I also know, as do you, that the leadership at UCLA is very well connected with State Water Board, which is the parent of the Division of Drinking Water.
Correct.
You know, so I'm anticipating, based on our interaction with UCLA and permitting the wastewater side of it, that they're hustling along pretty good in Division of Drinking Water, too. We haven't dropped that. You know, we're still in contact. We're just not the point of constriction, you know, or the next milestone in the path. They've already cleared us as a milestone, and they're with the Division of Drinking Water right now.
But, you know, the reason I brought it up is that, you know, as the name implies here, it's a pilot project. So as the years goes by, we talked earlier about replacement water and, you know, the short-term fix of bottled water providing, which we agreed is not sustainable. These tends to be probably more on the sustainability of long-term solutions. So I'm thinking the engineer here, okay, pilot project's going to take a couple of years at least or more to kick the tires. 2018 at best, you know, this will be a 2020, 2021 where, you know, all the bugs have been addressed, and as the years goes by, you know, we still have groundwater contamination. So I would suggest to have a little gentle nudge to our counterpart of the drinking water division, you know, to keep this process going. I would love to see 2018 not being the year of the drinking water division permit, but actually getting this rolling. And I think the fund is secure, right?
Yes. Yeah, so the funding through the implementation, and I think a full operation is secure. Yeah.
I'd like to second what you said. I think, you know, this is where the rubber meets the road, and we have tested, and it's time to really just move forward. These are longstanding issues. I think that the time is right. Obviously, Sigma is moving forward. There are other efforts, both for sustainability and contamination issues in our groundwater, and we should be coalescing with those efforts and just advancing the issue. I think it's the time is now, so I appreciate that point.
Thank you. Of course. Yeah.
Angela, thank you for your patience and bearing with us, because I know you have a lot to report to the board in terms of the broad range of ways in which you, I think, have managed to work with staff to bring out these issues, clarify where these issues fall within a broad range of programs. So I'll just say that to begin with. But as far as the UCLA project, you know, from my view, and I've heard from other board chairs at WQCC, and then I didn't attend the EJ summit last year, but I did in the year prior. And we all agree that we're looking at third world or undeveloped country level conditions in the state of California. So this pilot project is just phenomenal that we have the opportunity to iron out what a system like this, what this type of operation would take to do it properly with meeting all the regulations and all the standards, including waste discharge. And So I want to comment to the executive officer and to Angela and her leadership in working that out, because I know, and I have, you know, been following the process. The permitting was the big issue all along for the waste discharge, and it did take longer than we expected, and that's the nature of it. It's the science, it's the regulations, it's finding your way through, navigating a path through, making sure that we're not setting up a situation that can't be complied with, and at the other end, not prohibiting innovation from moving us forward, because I can tell you that if this UCLA project bears fruit and the system is actually viable, both technically and financially, economics, this could have such a huge impact on the state as a whole. So I think, you know, it did take more time, and I'll acknowledge that, but I do want to commend staff and Mr. Robertson Yeps at the...
I want to say thank you. I appreciate you've been attentive to this the whole time, you know, from when I was a section manager.
Right.
Engaging with UCLA, understanding that they were contemplating Region 3 or Region 5, I was trying to get them focused on Region 3 and provide them assurances that the board had its attention on this issue, as did staff, understanding the need for replacement water for disadvantaged communities. What we learned, I also appreciate the comments about the unanticipated complexity of permitting the wastewater coming out of the treatment system. What we learned in this is kind of a three-dimensional pilot. It's not just piloting telemetry associated with wellhead treatment. It's also, how does government become nimble in permitting these things as they proliferate through highly polluted areas that are dependent on groundwater, like the southern end of the Central Valley or the Salinas Valley? What we learned is we're not nimble. We're not quick enough. We have to, and this is state and regional, we have to create vehicles that allow quicker permitting. We weren't really sure what the effect of the wastewater coming out of the wellhead treatment system would do once it was in the on-site wastewater system, too. So we actually staff layered in monitoring to get a better understanding of, have this nitrate, we've lifted it up from groundwater, it's run through a household, what's going to happen to it inside the on-site wastewater treatment system? Is it going to knock down nitrate significantly or not? And so there's another aspect of where we're piloting or trying to gain data to better understand as these proliferate, these wellhead treatment systems proliferate, is our understanding of wastewater treatment appropriate? Is our strategy appropriate here? So it's kind of a three-dimensional pilot project in that not just the wellhead treatment component, but the wastewater component, and then our permitting nimbleness too. So learned a lot. I think we're probably still going to learn some more too along the way.
And just to acknowledge that the permitting issues for that project were handled by section manager Harvey Packard and his staff, and really do want to commend staff persons Christina Olmos and Howard Kolb for really looking at innovative ways to both recognize the potential impact of the discharge and then to construct some innovative monitoring program. And then we were able to get the grant funds to support that work. This is actually a picture on the lower right-hand corner of the UCLA container on the inside, so that's all fitting in a 40-foot trucking container, which would just be, could be moved from site to site, essentially. So lastly, I wanted to also mention the contract that we have with Kennedy Communications that Dr. Wolf mentioned earlier. She's conducting an environmental justice needs assessment for the southern part of the region. Specifically, Ms. Kennedy is assessing the needs related to community water systems, domestic wells, as well as tribal and subsistence fishing beneficial uses in areas in the southern part of Santa Barbara County, Lompoc, Guadalupe, actually it's more, I guess, more northern. in those areas where we really have a lack of information, unlike our areas in the northern part of the region. Her preliminary findings indicate there are a lot of differences. So, you know, our EJ issues in the northern part of the region of Monterey County are very different from the issues in the southern part of the county. One example of that that she's described to us is the domestic wells. So we don't have the same level of domestic well occurrence related to EJ communities in the southern part of the region. For example, migrant farm workers in the northern part of the region of Monterey County tend to live in the rural areas. And so the issues really are domestic wells that are serving these, you know, farm worker populations. In the southern part of the region, those, you know, farm workers live in the outskirts of the city, for example, in trailer parks and mobile homes and apartments or small motels. And so those are small community systems. They're not necessarily domestic wells. And so the way we monitor for them and the way we engage with them and the county is different. So we're looking forward to the results of her needs assessment, which will come in late May of this year, and we'll report out that when we get there. So moving,
can I just make a comment? So I think you're accurate to a large degree. However, there are a lot of concentrations of disadvantaged communities and workers within the cities themselves, not just on the margins of. There's a number of H2A. HUD facilities for farm workers in Lompoc, just right in the downtown area. So it's not only on, you know, in the margins of cities, but, you know, concentrated in the cities of Guadalupe and Santa Maria and portions of Carpinteria and Santa Barbara. Although the industries are really different, you know, you have sort of more transitional folks in the southern Santa Barbara County that work in different industries besides just agriculture. It's more of a service-based industry. So, yeah, so that's it. Thanks.
Yes, we're looking forward to the full results of her report. And she'll be part of her deliverables are to map those areas out and to identify the specific needs so that we can evaluate them with all of our other priorities. So that was just a real short list of the work we conducted in 2017. Many of those projects we anticipate continuing into 2018. Some examples of those are our domestic well testing projects, for example. Matthew Keeling, as part of our CCAMP GAP program, is working on implementing a region-wide domestic well testing program. We are continuing our Slow County domestic well testing program and also looking at opportunities to expand that to Santa Barbara County, pending the results of Maria Elena Kennedy's needs assessment. We are also, in 2018, planning to, and the work plan is attachment 2 in the staff report, to leverage opportunities to collaborate with others to continue to advance our EJ priorities. One example of that is the Integrated Regional Water Management Disadvantaged Communities Involvement Projects. For example, you'll hear more about this as part of Item 11, the work conducted by the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water. We'll also continue our efforts to reduce nitrate loading by evaluating options for requirements in Ag Order 4.0. And we're also going to be looking at some new environmental justice issues, such as the subsistence fishing beneficial uses that Maria Elena Kennedy is working on evaluating for the southern part of our region. Finally, I also wanted to describe to you that we are evaluating options to grow the regional EJ capacity. We found that the single most problematic aspect of successful projects in EJ communities is the limited capacity. EJ and DAC communities often do not have the knowledge and resources to identify and engage in the programs and the resources that are available to them. And we heard a little bit about that this morning related to the stewardship group's efforts to outreach to the EJ communities. So to successfully engage EJ and disadvantaged communities, it requires effective outreach, education, and technical support both in the short and long term, since most solutions take years to implement. Organizations that support EJ communities are helpful, but in our region, they're really limited geographically and often, you know, suffer from limited local knowledge and experience, which can be exacerbated by a high turnover rate in staff or lack of continuity. So to address this need, one of our priorities for 2018 is to work more closely with our EJ partners and to collaborate with State Board to identify some of these challenges and some viable options for growing EJ capacity in our region. So with that, I just wanted to thank the board for all of this time on this February agenda that's devoted to EJ issues. We'll have another item presented by Moises Moreno Rivera from the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water. But I really appreciate the continued support by the board, especially Dr. Hunter, who continues to report out as the EJ liaison. The stakeholders in our region greatly benefit from the genuine commitment of this board to have continued awareness of the EJ issues. And I often hear really positive comments about that genuine commitment to provide opportunities for public input on the decisions that affect their communities. And so with that, I'll just take any other questions that you might have.
You know, one thought, Angela, is that I think you correctly used plural when you refer to EJ organizations. And I think there is it is important to also, within EJ organizations, to have diversity in the efforts because of some of the limited resources available with some of the organizations. So the sum of all, you know, makes it a lot more comprehensive in terms of being able to get good coverage geographically, but also in depth. So, you know, I'm glad to hear that that's part of the big picture here.
I just wanted to point out the item 11, hearing item, also brings up another aspect of this, and that is how we define disadvantaged communities. I think we're working as part of a statewide effort to bring clarity to that. And I note that, you know, in the earliest version of kind of a tracking of our program resources and where the needs might be, you know, we identified in Monterey County, we identified three cities, but we're also moving into that perspective of smaller scale and clustered neighborhood level. And so I know we have census tracts identified where likely median household income will meet the disadvantaged community status, but that still doesn't, I mean, we're still a long way from being able to actually pinpoint and allocate resources at a state level for this the difficulty in defining what a disadvantaged community is and making sure that the benefits of these efforts and the priorities at recognizing what the challenges are for these communities, that we're continuing to move, you know, in the right direction. So I appreciate staff making this priority, bringing it to the board, and showing us very creative ways, because I do not believe we have any staff PY that are dedicated to environmental justice concerns, and yet the governor has shown great leadership in identifying this issue, and so it's been up to us to interpret that signal from the governor to figure out how to make progress with these issues. I think the staff has done a very good job of integrating, finding those integrated priorities, and then defining them, articulating them clearly. So, again, Howard Kolb and Matt Keeling, and there have been so many, Katie McNeil, there have been so many staff members that have been very creative at how they efficiently and effectively are helping all of us to better understand where these issues occur. So I look forward to tomorrow's discussion on DAC. I won't go any further with that, but I think that's another area where the state is moving, and we're glad to hear that, because all that water bond money, there's money earmarked for DACs, and yet we don't know how to define it. So we're still in that position. Thank you.
Ms. Gray?
Oh, okay. Looking on my left.
Now that you called on me, I will defer, though, to tomorrow's conversation. I mean, again, I think the IRWM regions, there is funding out there, and to the extent that we can incorporate a lot of that Central Coast funding area, IRWM findings and data and information. We really need to do that. There's a lot of it that exists. So.
I just have a couple of questions in terms of the overall plan. Well, first, I'm wondering if we have had any success in establishing contact with the Salinans, the Salinan Ohlone. They go by different names in the Salinas Valley. They have kind of been they're not a recognized tribe, and they sort of went underground about 100 years ago because they figured that was the best way to survive. But they have a very definite presence in the Salinas Valley. So that's my first question.
So I have not had any direct contact. I've definitely been working with Gia Kapahi. She has a very well-organized outreach to tribal communities because it's part of Assembly Bill 52 requires us to take certain steps to, I can't remember the name of that that procedure, but I know that the Salinas Ohlone is part of that list and that she does have a generic contact that she tries to reach out to, but we haven't received anything back, but that's definitely something we can follow up
okay,
with.
Okay, I also know that besides the folks down in the Salinas Valley, King City, Lockwood, Soledad, Greenfield area, that there is a group of Ohlone that kind of continues to function in the Watsonville area, and I could probably dig up contact information for them.
That would be helpful. I think we have just one person contact who is not being responsive, and so if you have a more local contact.
Yeah, I know they've actually done some stuff using Pinto Lake, some cultural stuff in the lake, so that's relevant to some stuff we're doing there. Second, subsistence fishing. I see you're examining that in the southern area of the region. I would point you to a couple of other areas where I've observed what I think is subsistence fishing. One would be Pinto Lake and the other lakes in the Pajaro Valley. There's a robust community of bass fishermen, and they're generally catch and release. But there's also, I see people riding their bicycles with their fishing pole to go fish at the lake, and I'd be prepared to bet money that some of those folks are subsistence fishers. And the other area I would point you to is, and I don't know if this is impacted or not, but I see quite a bit of fishing in the channel that goes into Moss Landing Harbor, which is, of course, the mouth of Elkhorn Slough. And, you know, I don't know if there's sufficient tidal flow that is not really impacted by nitrates, but certainly Elkhorn Slough is heavily. So that doesn't seem too hard to check out. We actually have a former board chair who's, I think, still on the Harbor Commission there at Moss Landing. And finally, I'm just wondering in terms of the human right to water and disadvantaged communities, kind of where we are on the Chromium 6 stuff, because I would suspect that impacts a whole number of disadvantaged communities, including some decent-sized municipal systems in our region.
So Chrome 6 is, definitely something that we're looking at, especially related to the domestic well data. So that's not an area where we have a lot of data for domestic wells. And we've included it in our San Luis Obispo County well sampling. It also will be included in our region-wide sampling. The results so far have indicated, at least in the areas that we've sampled, it's not prevalent. I think Taya might be able to answer more specifically about the larger systems. I don't know if we have any information, but I haven't done the analysis yet of where that intersection is with disadvantaged communities. I know that there is a report by the State Board that the Division of Drinking Water is looking at, and it's, I think it's AB 222, and it's about communities that rely upon contaminated water systems, disadvantaged communities that rely on contaminated water systems, and Chrome 6 is part of that. And so they are working with the regional boards to help identify, for grant funding purposes, where we need to address.
Yeah, I seem to remember that City of Watsonville, under the new standards, has Chrome 6 issues, and depending on how you define a disadvantaged community, a pretty huge chunk of Watsonville actually is that. I mean, I know the definition is a sticky question, but
I know that the IRWM, the Pajaro IRWM, had a number of Chrome 6 projects, and so looking at their IRWM plan would really be helpful to because there's a number of projects that address disadvantaged communities in the Chrome 6 issue.
And that's definitely one of the plans for 2018 is to really look at the IRWM plans and to look at the community involvement projects and to start identifying where we can leverage both some of that information that's being generated as well as to support their efforts as another external partner.
So looking now on my right, any...
Yeah, I just had a general question that seems to be coming up when we talk about the replacement drinking water programs and interventions, because people are really concerned with nitrate-contaminated waters that people are showering in and perhaps doing other of their household business with. So I'm wondering about the research in terms of the health outcomes, where I know a lot of the emphasis is on drinking water and ingestion in that manner, but other research in regards to showering in nitrate-contaminated water, and then how that is also guiding some of the proposed work in disadvantaged communities.
So the research that we focused on was really looking at the recent results related to nitrate ingestion from drinking water. And fortunately, there is some more recent information about that. Before the results, the studies were more generic, you know, sort of looking at the overall consumption of nitrate, nitrogen from, you know, your leafy greens and preserved meats, for example. But there are some studies that, can affirm now the nitrate and public health impacts from the exposure to drinking water. There isn't a lot of information, unfortunately, on showering and exposure those ways, but it's not obviously an inhalation issue. It's about the volume of the water that you might ingest if you're a child in a bathtub or something like that. So it is something that all of the public health outreach materials that I've observed, USCPA and the counties do definitely talk about the potential for ingestion, especially from young children while bathing, et cetera. So it's an important area of outreach and education.
So on the topic of water exposure during showering, et cetera, you know, there's been some recent studies that pointing out to the fact that some of the soap, shampoos, etc., you know, depending on which particular type is being used, you know, can be even much more significant health effect than actually, you know, the water itself. That gets into the whole business of chemicals emerging concern. So that I just wanted to mention that there's that other added complexity. So at this stage, do we have any further question for Angela, Dr. Hunter? Okay. So certainly, again, I'll use the same observation as I made at the previous item, which is work in progress. I think if we look at our region activity, because, you know, sometimes it's easy to look on the inside and we don't look on the outside. You know, Central Coast region, we're not our own little island, and we do have opportunities to see how other regions are performing in this particular sector. And I would say, and maybe Mr. Robertson can further comment on this, but We're making good progress on our efforts. I would say we're definitely not at the caboose of a train in the efforts. Is there a lot of room for improvements? Absolutely, no doubt. But I think we're chipping away. What's your observation with your monthly EO phone calls?
Right. So actually, I have weekly EO phone calls.
That's correct. Yeah.
I agree with your assessment. Is that as a whole, we're probably more attuned than virtually any other region. Perhaps San Diego region actually is different issues. Is very much in tune with their disadvantaged community and homeless populations and things like that. They're focused on a different facet of the water quality and human health issues attached to disadvantaged communities. Looking back internally, I don't want to pat ourselves on the back too much. We should recognize that we're making good progress here. On the north end, we have a much higher awareness of the needs and locales of disadvantaged communities. On the south half of the region, just to summarize, we don't have that kind of pixelation, you know, or a real detailed understanding of the locations. And we're starting to get there through Maria Elena Kennedy's work, but we're playing a little catch-up there in terms of we'll still need to do more needs analysis, I think, down there. But at least we have the awareness of where we need to work harder to, you know, just as an internal summary of where we're at.
And I think this is an area, again, it illustrates the importance of being able to leverage our board members' knowledge of, you know, the local situation. You know, Mike, example, you know, that you gave about specific locations, you know, that's not something, you know, from San Luis Obispo we would be aware of. Jane, you know, your contacts where you help open the door, you know, that's helpful too. Monica, you know, likewise. So I think it's a team effort. excuse me, and also a financial resource. You know, limitation sometime.
So the other thing I'll hit that note again. Angela already mentioned it. Is that we need to increase the capacity of environmental justice groups available to start assessing needs, designing responses to needs, and then implementing those responses. Radically under capacity there.
I will say that it's important to also just capitalize and synergize on the efforts that are already underway in some of those areas. I mean, they might not be groups that are known to the water board, but there are people, you know, in at least Santa Barbara County that are working on those issues and are trusted. And so, you know, getting in touch with those organizations like CAUSE and people like that would be really helpful in advancing a lot of the issues that the water board is concerned about.
I think that's a great point. I think it's more our awareness than it is that they're not happening. Yeah, I completely agree.
And that gets back to my comment about using the plural rather than singular is to use, you know, the synergy of all these different organizations and some of which are local and some of which may actually end up be in other parts of the state, not because of their knowledge of our specific geography, but their prior experience on how to address EJ. So we need to broaden our outreach, so to speak, with some of these other groups. Go ahead, Monica.
I want to just put a little perspective on this as well. You know, we're talking about EJ, but I think in all regards, when we are facing these problems that are multifaceted and complex and years long looking back and years long going forward to solutions, I think overall working with community partners is a huge element of what we do. So with irrigated lands, we wouldn't be seeing the kind of progress we're making without the involvement of partnering with organizations, both those that have emerged to address the program needs, the way in which implementation is going forward, as well as on, you know, on the flip side of the coin, the same kinds of impacts emanating from industry and impacts to community. We're looking for the ability to work with partners in all different ways. And so I think that is something that we want to continue to prioritize. And every time we have this conversation, guess what? Something new comes up. We hear about a new group, or we hear about a new contact, a new person, an advocate. And thank you, Michael, for identifying Ohlone, because in the Central Coast, the tribal communities are not consolidated, and they are very dispersed. And so it's worth having this update. It's worth having this conversation, because we do learn new things, and we're hearing about good progress. We're also hearing about where not progress is not happening, and that's where we come in to be able to alert our sister agencies and bring all the tools to the table, every possible way we can, both regulatory and in terms of authorities and jurisdictions. So that's a role that I think we've also learned has paid off for us in many ways. So I would add that just as some balance.
So thank you very much. I think this probably wraps up any question that we have. Again, Angela, thank you for the update. At this time, we will take the lunch break for 1 hour. We will have a closed session that Ms. Jarre will be leading. When we reconvene, we will address item 11, which we took out of sequence because of the arrival of the representatives who were to cover that topic.
I just need to announce for closed session, we'll be discussing items 3 and 7.
So 1:30, we reconvene. Thank you.